Mikhail, welcome.
Welcome, Mikhail.
It's great to have you. So on the panel today, Joe Fernandez from Secret Co. and Clout and Joy Mode, and Kevin from Airhouse, Julian from Practice, Mikhail from, X Unsplash, X Crew, X, what was it called before that? I want to talk to you about, we have a long history going back many, many years. You had a huge influence on me, and it sounds like Kevin and some other people too.
Yes.
I'm curious about, I want to talk about whatever you want to talk about, but I'm excited about to hear about pivots and what you could tell people about pivots. You have a remarkable history because you did this thing out of Founder Fuel in Montreal.
Yep.
Then you're like, not good enough, which takes a lot of courage. You pivoted to a company Crew with not a lot of capital. And this company Crew, you were like, kind of half works. I would love to hear it in your own words. And then you worked on a side project, which was this thing, Unsplash. And Unsplash began as a marketing project, and you doing this effectively content marketing, you know? And then that's the thing, but it's like you had the courage to like shift the company again and again and again. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you. It's great to chat again. And I want to hear that, you know, version of that story from your perspective and how it felt and, you know, how you're doing.
Yeah. The first one, you were speaking about the switches and the courage. I think some of it was I was like dumb also. Like,
right.
I was really young. I didn't know any better. And a lot of those early changes, we didn't even tell the board. I didn't know you're supposed to tell the board. Like, we were just, and then we were small, like we were seed. So we didn't have that much capital. We didn't have a big board. But a lot of it was, you started to learn what product market fit feels like as you made more stuff. And when Unsplash happens, you're like, oh, that's what it's supposed to feel like. And you've done these other things in the past where it felt more like you were pushing and you're forcing it. And I think at a certain point you can get there with certain things like that, but Unsplash felt completely different. And it was like an accident, right? It was supposed to grow the other company, which was Crew. It was just meant to be a marketing project. But it just grew and we didn't have to do, we were doing all the opposite stuff that you're supposed to do, like not focusing on it. I would go in, it was free photos that anybody could download, right? It was just a blog. We didn't do any custom code, no hired engineers, nothing.
Right.
Every 10 days, I would just go in and see that there was photos and there was 20,000 new people subscribing.
Can you explain how it works for people? I'm sure most listeners know what Unsplash is, but just for people that don't.
Yeah, it's free high resolution images that you can use however you want. And the whole idea started, like my background was as a web designer and I just thought it was really hard finding good photos that I knew I could use. And figured maybe there's some people like that, but our customer base for Crew. So our Crew was a marketplace that connected engineers and designers, like the best of the best with good projects. So we were vetting both sides. So another one of my problems as a designer was just how do you find good work? And I knew the companies had a problem too, because I also had a company trying to figure that out at the same time. And it would grow, but you always had that marketplace challenge. I think it also just the marketplace challenge, part of it is not being quite good enough at the beginning to create like enough wow moments to get people to switch from what they're doing. And I know Julian and I actually spoke about that in the beginning.
Yes.
When he was a breather. And I said this thing about multiple wow moments. And I remember Julian being like, wait, what do you mean multiple wow moments?
Yeah.
We kind of dug into that where it's that why you have to be 10x better. You can't just be 2x better.
Right.
2x better is one wow moment, but you need a ton of them all together to really get people to switch.
That's an amazing, you know, this is just another thing that you came to me with. We were sitting at a bar and I was like, my company, I don't think has product market fit and I don't know what I'm doing and it's not growing. And
this
I
is
remember,
what you said or what
I said? I said this to Mikhail.
About breather.
About breather.
I remember Julian texted me. He's like,
it was a very meaningful, super important moment to me. And we were sitting at a bar. It was like Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's. And we were like alone is my memory. There were not a lot of people at this bar. And it was in the old part near where I, not in front where you live, but in Montreal. And so you said just grow 8% a week, which is the YC attitude. And I was like, I panicked internally. And these, it turns out to be my best moments often is when I panic, just not in the moment, just afterwards. And you said, grow 8% a week. And I said, I don't know how to fucking do that. And you were like, just drive to that number, just give people that goal and you will figure it out. And I did that as of Jan 1. I came back New Year's. We're going to grow 8% a week, everyone. Everyone panicked. And you were right. And we did grow 8% a week, but we did it by panicking, actually. Right. And so what is your version of that that you can remember? Like, where did that happen? I'm sure it's happened a few times in your business, but what can you remember?
Yeah, it was all the time, because you're just running out of, especially in the beginning, right? You're just running out all the time. You're running out of ideas. You're running out of people. You're running out of money.
Right.
Yeah.
It was just always like this thing in the beginning, especially. And I think that's actually what led to all these business changes. They were super rapid, because you're trying to get this thing to grow and you're doing all of these things to make it grow. That's what Unsplash was. Mm-hmm. So Unsplash was, how do we grow 8% week over week? Because we have to raise money in 3 to 4 months from now.
Right.
We can't grow the normal way. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough money to throw at ads or the
right.
We don't even know what they look like. We'll run out of money before that happens.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be more creative. And I think some of this came from even watching Airbnb, some of the stuff they did in the early days when their backs were at the wall with the Obama O's and the cereal,
right,
kind of thinking. And I remember what we really ingrained in us at that early stage is you probably need at least one exploit, is what we called it.
Okay.
In order to make it, especially if you're a marketplace.
Can you dig into that? What does that mean to you, an exploit?
So an exploit, this came from the thing that Airbnb did where they exploited Craigslist.
Right.
Like, they don't talk about it that often, but they had that automated machine that would take the listings. And it's like illegal, but that's why it's kind of like an exploit. It sits in this like gray area.
Wait, hold on a second. I want to push back on this, if I may.
Yes.
You said illegal. It certainly pushed the boundaries. What people don't know about Airbnb sometimes is there's Brian Chesky. There's, God, what's his name? Joe Gebbia. And then there's a third guy sitting in the shadows. And
Nathan.
People don't talk about him, but I think he was a super affiliate. And I think he was a growth hacker and he did a lot of sketchy stuff in his background. He's a billionaire now. So it turns out, okay, his name is Nate something. Russian or kind of Polish name. And he's the one that did this, but it wasn't illegal. I wanted to clarify.
Yes. Sorry. I mean, like,
It was against Craigslist terms of service.
Something like that, where it's just this gray area.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, and it's like often frowned upon by people who don't want to grow that way. And they just think you have to grow.
One way. Right.
Someone on, in a group of CEOs that I know, came to me recently and started talking to me about marketing tactics, because at Practice we're growing from our six figure kind of like ARR at the moment to the first million in ARR. And we were talking about that. And the feedback from this CEO is your marketing people are too Canadian. And and I don't know, Mikhail, if that resonates with you, but it's this idea.
That's not a good thing.
No, I know it's not a good thing.
That's not.
They're good marketers, to be clear.
Yeah. Kevin, Canadian.
No. Well, I'm also American now too. No. I'm not going to critique your marketers, but that saying is not a good thing.
Yeah. What he means is they're not aggressive enough. And I think that's your point, Mikhail, right? This idea of the marketing people / the product people. What you're talking about with this exploit, double clicking on that, it's something that other people haven't found that kind of cost zero, probably.
Yeah.
And so when you had one, how did it, I mean, you talked about product market fit, what it felt like. So what did it feel like to find that exploit? Talk to me about how you got there and what it was.
Yeah. So the exploits are best in that like 0 to 1. So your company, you're still trying to make it very, very early. Later, I do think you need a really strong, consistent marketing channel, but that should happen after you've already got a good product. But in the beginning, you don't have a good product, you don't have good marketing, you don't have anything.
Right.
And especially to get it just to like take, you need something like unique. And Even with Unsplash, when Unsplash was growing, again, my mind always went to these exploits. And at the same time, so Unsplash was an exploit for Crew, that business.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we made an exploit for Unsplash, which was Medium. So Medium, the blogging platform, was starting at the exact same time.
Yep.
Kind of blowing up, and you had the leaderboard. What's great about exploits, there's kind of a formula to it. You target early stuff. Huh? So early companies that probably are going to do well. So this is founded by Ev Williams, the founder of Twitter, that's likely going to do pretty well. But in the beginning, they haven't like figured out everything, right? They don't have the algorithms all tuned.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, well, all of this stuff. So they just had the leaderboard page, and they had huge high-res images all the time on those. So I was like, well, I could try to convince writers to use Unsplash, or I could just write. That's probably the fastest way to get there. And what could I do realistically over and over? I could probably write one a week. We have a newsletter list from our company that's probably interested in what I'm writing anyway. Let me see if we can just consistently get there.
Yeah.
And that's what started to happen. So every week we would have a trending post that was using the Unsplash image, high res image, link back to Unsplash. All the Medium writers started seeing that because they would all see the top posts, even the consumers, the people who just read it. And that'll link back to Unsplash again, creating these loops. So that's what that would feel like. It just feels like a great product also. Like it just keeps catching, right? Like stuff just keeps catching and flowing, and you kind of know when you really hit that mark.
Joe, I'm curious. Joe, I can see your brain going. Tell me what your brain is thinking right now. I can see it going and thinking. What is happening to you?
Yeah, I mean, it really resonates back to the early clout days. And, you know, we found a bunch of these exploits. And the notion of clout and the kind of ego crack of it and kind of where Twitter was in that moment. You know, we just had people talking about their clout scores all day. And it created this curiosity of, I want to know my score. And if this person scores this, then what's mine? And Mikhail's so right. Like if you can find that for your company in those early days, it, you know, it's often really the difference between life and death of your startup.
Was there an exploit that you guys found like through the Twitter algorithm or something that actually made it possible that was like pushing the bounds for you, Joe, Clout?
I mean, we just made it, we were so optimized around getting people to share their scores.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was difficult to use Clout and not share your score. And so like, you know, the amount of content coming out, and then, you know, then the next big exploit was we figured out these Clout perks, which was getting free stuff because of your Clout score.
Right.
And then you couldn't help but brag about the free stuff you got. And, you know, the loops continued.
Right.
I remember they had a Twitter integration, so you could see the Clout score next to everybody.
Yeah, Chrome extension, right?
Yeah, but that little Chrome plugin was huge.
Oh, Chrome plugin, yeah.
Yeah, I use it too. Yeah, yeah. Everybody in your feed had a Clout store.
Our Twitter account for our first company, I was just like, okay, go follow the engineering account, find all the people with high Clout that are following that and follow them. And then we would hit the maximum limit that you could follow. Those people would follow the account, and we just built up this big following. My wife did it every morning, actually on the way to the on the way to Founder Field, Kevin. We'd ride in.
Nice.
And we just wait 30 minutes.
Were y'all in the same cohort?
We were.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
This is weird.
Yeah.
Kevin, were you working on Ship or something else?
This is something else. This is my very first company that started. It was a shopping company.
Looking back on what you know now, Kevin, is it like, do you sometimes look back at like failed projects and think, oh, if only I knew, and that was a good idea, but it couldn't, and I could have gotten it somewhere or something like that? Or do you look back on them differently, like what a waste of time or something in between?
Definitely in between. I think that all the companies, except for Airhouse, I think Ship definitely could have existed, but not at a venture scale. I think you could have like rolled it out city by city and done in very like a bootstrappy kind of way. But it wouldn't have been like a massive business. My other business that I was with Mikhail and Founder Fuel was around locating the best deals from like, and this is before e-commerce was as big as it was now, like locating the best deals around the stores around you, and trying to get inventory data from that and trying to get you to go inside the store. So I don't think that that business could not exist. There's a version of it. It's called Shopkick that kind of, they kind of made it work. But it's really tough to track that offline to online conversion. So I don't think it could have really worked. But I think for myself, like I wouldn't have changed anything as far as like, what a waste of time. Like all of those things, like amazing learnings. Like as Mikkel brought up earlier, like a lot of the stuff that he maybe did, like didn't tell his board and all this stuff. And it's just like, cause you need to learn somehow, and it's better to push the bounds and then learn versus not pushing those. And so I think that, for my career path, like we definitely push the bounds a lot at SHIP. And I learned a ton from that. And then I've tried to not make the same mistake twice.
It really resonates with me, this idea of, it's like, you got to try everything because you don't get a safe point is kind of the way I think about it. Sometimes you just got to run through the gauntlet of the startup and it gets to whatever end that it does. And if I remember correctly, Mikkel, the only thing that's different about you, you look the same since the last time I saw you.
Except I don't think you age.
Your hoodie is more expensive. And I think that's it looks more expensive. Maybe it's the house behind you. And it's because
it's
you
also
sold
not my house.
You sold Unsplash to Getty Images by the end of this. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so at that point, looking back on it now, are you like, this is an exciting outcome for you? Do you wish you kind of could have kept going? It was this a natural end for the company, or could it have gone some other way?
Yeah, we sold the company 2 years ago. Like in hindsight, really good move for everything. Like what's going on now,
right?
Also great for Getty. Like Getty went public, and we were much a part of that. We represented like the creative long tail and what's happening with image use around that. So it was cool. It was amazing to see like the story of Unsplash be in Times Square and on the New York Stock Exchange and talking about it. So getting to do all of that, that was like a big exciting part of the acquisition. The challenge that we were facing was monetization. Like we had a ton of usage and we can monetize. We knew we could monetize in like a pro account kind of way in a monthly subscription. But we just had doubts about how big that could actually be. And we tended to really want to take big swings. So we started with an advertising business, which is like, what the fuck are you doing? Don't start an advertising business. And it was unique. We weren't trying to out-track anybody.
But also give people a sense of like the scale, because you guys had like how many monthly active users on the site did you have?
It was so gigantic, this thing. And it might still be gigantic. And the impressive part is it was growing. At these, it would be like, it's 100 million visits. I would love to hear the numbers from you, but I just want to talk about the feeling of looking at these every little while.
Right.
It kept growing 20% month over month, like nonstop, even at insane scales. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it was a top 150 website in the world.
Wow.
We do over 100 million image downloads a month, which is more than Shutterstock, Getty, and Adobe Stock combined.
Wow.
So yeah, way bigger than basically the entire market that laughed at us 6 years ago when we started as a little blog, and really owning all of the top SEO terms around free image and these sorts of things. And to your point, yeah, when you start seeing that, it's a bit weird. Like you actually have to create those models in your head to grasp the size of those numbers, you know, like this could fit in the stadium. Right. And because you can't understand, it's like, and they go up and it almost doesn't affect you, because also when you're in it, especially when you're really building and you're raising money, that makes you numb to these numbers too. It's like, they don't matter.
Right.
Because the customer, which is the investor that you're talking to, makes you feel like it really doesn't matter. And even for us, it felt a bit when we were fundraising, like Julian, back to your point about growth. At that time, I really thought if you grew that would solve everything. And that's why I was so focused on that number.
Okay.
We went to raise money for Unsplash. I actually realized that in some cases, growth is not enough.
This is fascinating to me.
Even if it's like insane growth.
Which kind of pushback did you get back from investors?
We had the weirdest stuff. It was like we had cap table issues, right? Because we had the same cap table, same investor base, everything, all the way through all of this stuff.
Don't start a company in Canada.
That's not
a warning from everybody here.
No, but that's not. Kevin's the anti-Canadian Canadian.
Don't do it.
Those Canadian investors do some weird stuff.
I thought that was like, cool, people will like solve that. It's fine. It's like paperwork. Mm. Like, it's growing great. And then even you show the growth and it was like, okay, how are you going to monetize? And I think part of it was, yeah, we're first time founders. Basically we're coming from Canada.
Yeah. Right?
I'm not Zuckerberg or one of the people who worked with him at Facebook who had some track record of building an ad business around a big scale thing. So even though we scaled it and grew it a lot, there was just doubts around. Those were really the two main pieces, and monetization was a big one for them.
And if I remember correctly, it's also like every investor, maybe not every investor, but I feel like the lead investors in this business as it iterated and grew were always, I mean, all investors are weirdos to a degree, but you had the weirdest of the weird. So first of all, you have the infamous John Stokes, and then you had Fred Destin. If I remember correctly, right? Atlas or whatever other thing. And then you had Jeff. Is it Jeff Lewis? Is that the name?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also like the weirdest of the weird. And it's.
Wait, and Jeff Lewis from Bedrock?
Yeah. Temp Check Jeff Lewis. Yes.
Okay. I watch his Temp Checks. Yep. Got it.
So these are not normal people. And they could take that as a compliment, maybe actually. But it goes to show as to, you know, your growth is not enough because obviously that was the story. The growth was not an issue. So what does it take in addition to growth is, I guess, the question, right? Like, I kind of feel the same way. It's like, if it's growing enough and it's not negative unit economic, let's fucking go.
Yeah. I think especially when you're a first-time founder, there's always like there's going to be a big one that investors are going to come up with. There's going to be something. For a second-time founder, I actually think, they'll probably be like, oh, they can figure it out a bit more. They're like 50%. Yeah. Cool. We see the risk, but Kevin, Julie, and Joe, they've been through some shit. Like, I bet you they can figure that out. They give you a bit more credit, I feel, because I've seen it happen. I'm like, we have way more growth than this company, and we have a better monetization plan than them that is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But it just feels like I'm too risky. And it didn't matter how much I improved my presentation, did certain things. They just saw that like from track record.
Do you think anything did it have to do with you guys? And this is back before the remote days and companies would be funded anywhere globally. Do you think it had something to do with you guys being based in Canada?
I do. I think it got a little better as the years went. So from 2012, 2013 would have been the worst.
Right.
Everything started for us.
It was that.
And then it progressively got better. Like you had a bit more cred, but it's like.
You get Shopify there and it's getting some more cred, but but still you had, in Canada, you had what? Shopify, Hootsuite.
Well, you had Kik turned into, is the founders of Kik turned into the founders of Substack, right? And it's, but the first company Kik was in Canada, if I remember correctly. So there are these stories, but they're not sexy and they're not quite weird. They're not quite, there's not enough of them. There's so many. Joe,
I think it probably has 2x the credit it had in 13, but it's still not at the level of, we would have been in the Bay Area. I think there might've been a different perception of our.
You would have had relationships with 15 different investors. They would have said, I know him. He's going to figure it out. And so fuck it.
Right. Well, not even the relationship piece. And this is the reason that I moved to the Bay Area. From Canada, I saw that it was just, I saw similar like scale companies on like my very first company, and that were getting funded in like the Bay Area. And it was just like, cause they were based there. And so at that time, and it probably doesn't relate a lot to people listening now because that definitely is not the case as much. And everybody's remote and all that, But it really was like, if you're not in the Bay Area, like, also, like, I don't want to go and fly for a board meeting, or I don't want to do just these like silly things. And then there was like a pattern matching part of like, oh, Canadian companies, they just don't have the returns of like Bay Area. And also, if you guys remember too, there was like a Bay Area versus New York as well for right, a long for sure. time. And now that's completely changed. And now that's opened up to Austin, and I'll argue. I'm actually not going to argue from Miami, but there's a lot of hype around that. Yeah, there's a lot of investors, and that's one of the main reasons that I moved down to the Bay Area to start SHIP, was just, I wanted to give myself as much as an advantage as I possibly could.
Joe, I know you think of yourself and maybe feel that you still are an outsider, and, you know, Las Vegas, you didn't come from Stanford, you know, all these other kind of things. I'm wondering if this resonates with you and what your experience is.
Yeah, I actually started Clout in New York City. And, you know, back, this is 2000, you know, late 2008, early 2009, really was not the New York tech scene we see today. It did not exist then.
Right.
And I knew I was so reliant on the data from the platforms, you know, Twitter in those days specifically, that more than anything, I wanted to be friends with them. And, you know, so I started spending a ton of time in San Francisco, and then it just made sense for my wife and I to move out there. And those years in San Francisco were a huge advantage in that moment. And I don't think Clout would have been what it became without that. To Mikhail's earlier point, I also wish Clout was my second company, because I think I would have got a lot more breathing space from investors and room to make the mistakes I made without overreaction. But certainly being in that geography in that moment was critical. And, I'm thankful I was able to use it as a slingshot out of that area, because I love building in LA right now. But, I think there, if you weren't in San Francisco historically or in the Bay Area at some point with those relationships, you did pay a tax on kind of how everyone perceived you and what deals you got access to.
A drag on your financing, whatever it was, like an anchor, you know, yeah, as you're trying to sail away, the anchor is kind of dragging on the bottom of the ocean. Is that, a little bit kind of how it felt to me. And I'm wondering, is that how it feels still? I'm not sure, you know, because I know that I'm not a usual founder. Like, I'm Canadian, and there's a couple of us. The Sonder founder, he's not Canadian anymore. He's in Los Angeles, who's also funded by Andrew Chen. Like, so it's kind of opened up, and I don't know if people care anymore. Mikhail, do you see it around you still, the drag? Would you describe it the same way?
Yeah, so going like back to the current problem, and with the advertising thing, we couldn't get what I thought of it as. We couldn't get in the cultural zeitgeist. And I think that's part of what this is. Like, if you're not in the, and before it was not the Valley, and now it's kind of like the Valley people talking on Twitter, plus some other people who also seem like they're in the Valley, but they're just on Twitter.
Right.
But there's that group that talks about, and you call it tech Twitter, whatever it is, they talk about like 10 companies, and it's like cheating for those 10 companies, because yep, they just get all the stuff. Yep. And I find that we could never get in there. No matter how much we grew, no matter how unique our thing was, I would fight for different things to try to make this happen. We never made this idea, but like, we wanted to be in Stratectory, for example. We're like, if Ben Thompson can write about us, everyone's going to see this and our beautiful thing, but he's never going to do it. So we're going to do it. And we're going to, he takes sick days. So we're going to make a site that's called stratectorysickday.com. And we're going to write for him on that day, our thing. This is the idea, but that's how desperate we were.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
In the zeitgeist. And anyone can steal this idea now, because we never did it. And I hope so.
But it's so amazing, because like, as you talk, like, your numbers, like 100 million like downloads, that's not even monthly active users. Your monthly active users must have been a lot higher. Like, what is that compared to, what is Quora, for example?
Quora, I think, I mean, at the time, and now we're probably similar. I mean, at Medium.
Which is crazy.
Medium, we're bigger than Giphy. just to give you an example. Right? Yeah, so people was pissing us off. Right?
Wow.
It's like,
wow.
Giphy that sold to Facebook for $250 million.
Giphy's right next to us.
Yeah.
Getting
and they wrote it off.
About usage of visuals. And we were, if you just did a quick search on website traffic.
But do you think ultimately, okay, so it obviously was like really hard to raise more capital. You guys weren't profitable because you hadn't rolled out. Had you actually rolled out your advertising platform?
No.
So you obviously weren't profitable. So you need venture capital. Do you think that you could have, kind of pushed forward without the acquisition and just made because is it easier to raise if you know people and all that, but like your usage numbers speak for themselves. And once you start getting that, like, I'm sure you had a pretty like small team, especially in Canadian dollars, that you were paying them. So you probably could have got to profitability pretty quick. Like, do you think was there an alternative path that obviously you were probably looking at doing that. But do you think you could have just like pushed forward, even though you weren't getting the attention? And also, like, to be clear, like, with my company now with Airhouse, we don't get any of that attention. Like with Ship, we get all the attention and nobody gives a shit what we're doing now, except for our customers and people in our area. And I actually enjoy it more. Yeah. But do you think you could have actually pushed through that, just given people love your product on both sides? Cause you had a marketplace too. I don't think we've talked about on the supply side, but you had like a lot of amazing photographers that were actually uploading stuff and, creating essentially the marketplace that the consumers use. Do you think you could have actually punched through it and actually made it?
So you had a couple things in there. First, like, I agree with Airhouse, for example. I think there's certain companies, if you don't need to be in the zeitgeist, you don't have to bite to be in there. Like with advertising, consumer advertising, if you kind of look at the playbooks of people who really took some share from Facebook and Google advertising, like Snap, when they were really coming up, they got into the zeitgeist. Like people, this is the new channel. You need enough people being like, this is the new channel, advertisers and stuff to go in. The only way I could see doing that was PR and all of this stuff. And that's really just getting into the cultural thing. Like TikTok was able to do it. Same thing. It's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have to do that, yeah, definitely don't do it. Like we didn't do it until we had to, until we saw advertising was our next biggest problem to solve. And we felt that was a solution that was part of it. Pushing through, one big factor was how messed up our cap table was.
Damn.
We just did the math on how long and how much revenue you would actually have to make in order to have certain outcomes. Like a normal company is $1 billion outcome, for example.
Yeah.
Us was like a $10 billion. We had to reach a $10 billion outcome.
You mean your personal, like what
just
you
like
would take.
Cap table. Like if you,
everyone,
if you looked at what the founders
had
owned by that point, because we had to pivot so much and figure out things. But the way all the investors were thinking about it when we were going to raise again, it just, the math never made any sense. Like
I gotta
so much, but it's just gonna mess up at some point.
This is a crazy story. And so first of all, and this also like takes 10 years. The thing that I guess I could see how someone listening to this, okay, I think most of the people listening to this are entrepreneurs to a certain degree, second, some remarkably high profile ones. A lot of people just starting out. And when they do, I can imagine them listening to your story, Mikhail, and being like, oh my God, he was number 150 website in the world. It's a husband and wife team, and it's a small team of people. They is really what I should be saying.
Just to give him a shout. And a third. We have a Nathan.
Yes. Yes. There's also a Nathan. That's true. I remember. So they're looking at 150 website in the world, 100 million downloads, could fill an auditorium and would beat out Rihanna in terms of audience members or whatever. And still the outcome was really hard and still they couldn't raise. I can imagine someone being like, I'm not going to start a fucking company. I can't beat that.
Good. They should think though.
No, we're trying to. What I'm saying, want people to start more companies.
You need to know, and still want to do it.
That's true. That's cool. That's my point. That's a great point.
Mm.
Like, you should hear this story and be like, I don't fucking care.
Right.
Yeah. I want to make this company so much that I don't care.
I'm going to be the exception.
That's the way. Like,
yeah.
I'm just curious. This cap table thing is really just like bothering me. do you think that there is? So, I mean, and maybe we could just even just like share, I don't know if anybody else has any experience with like changing cap tables and go for it, Julian. Like, what would you, for other people listening that maybe have like similar problems?
Yeah.
Most likely, Mikhail, what I'm reading between the lines, you had some like early investors, they took a big chunk of your company, probably in seed, and you pivoted quite a few times. You had to raise just like little itty bitty pieces of seed to continue the company and just like ate away at all of your ownership percentage. And you probably had like, and well, I don't know what your liquidation preference was or whatever, but you probably had some like weird terms just based on like, this company's not going to make it and stuff like that. Am I correct? And like,
we did big rounds, like multiple big rounds instead of small ones. The problem was once we had Unsplash to where it is and the amount of preferred capital that was sitting, people were like, that's the value of the company.
Mm.
Right.
So they were like, they were valuing where we were at Unsplash basically around probably one or two rounds to where we had already had all this capital.
Right.
Commit.
So the we were raising was too high.
And they were looking at it, or we were raising like Series B and they were looking at it like late stage seed.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Also because there's no model necessarily, right? And because speaking to your point, which is it almost feels like it's upsetting to hear this part of it, because you're like, we're not in the zeitgeist, but we're top 150 websites. Well, it's not quite like this, but it is a little bit in the sense that people just forget about it in the background. And they're like, yes. By the way, I'm not saying this about Unsplash at all. I think Unsplash is the best, but it's like Quora is like a piece of shit website. Like, who fucking uses that, even though it's top 100 in the world, right? And never quite in the zeitgeist. In fact, it's anti-zeitgeist. Lord knows if you use Quora, like, you're going down in terms of the rungs of how people think about you, maybe. I don't know.
And in some cases, some of this stuff is so good. Like, if you don't have to be in the zeitgeist, screw it, like we're saying, because a lot of people, when you ask them what their favorite tech product is or favorite app, no one says Google. But if because we forget it, right? Yeah. It's just like part of us now.
Right.
If you want to get there. Like, if you can get to that point, people don't even list you because you're so part of, like, they're just writing in the box. They don't even know it's you anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one lists Apple, no one lists Google. But if we didn't have that, you wouldn't even be able to function.
Julian, what was your experience on cap table?
Well, my prep stack got deliberately crunched in a round, because when it's a strange situation where people kept believing in Breather. And by the way, I continue to believe in the model, right? In sort of an abstract sense.
I love Breather.
People kept believing. Thank you. Yeah. People keep believing in it no matter what. And no matter how big the prep stack is, it's like someone else would pile onto it. So then you end up with any kind of challenge that you encounter. It's like you're going to need another kind of round to solve for it. By the way, pandemic being one of these major things, which destroyed real estate in general, right? So it's like, then you're like, okay, well, you got this giant pref stack. Like, who's going to invest on top of this pref stack? And my ownership wasn't crunched in the same way. But you can see how that it's more like the outcome likelihood is degrading for the next incremental investor each time, which is causing the model, not the model of the business, but the model of the investor to break down. Their underwriting model is saying, I can't make money on this because there's in my case, there's 120 or something plus million dollars in the pref stack. And I'm like just one of many, right? So does that resonate with you, Mikhail?
Yeah, I think talking solutions out of this. One, Number one solution, don't get in the problem.
Right.
Raising too much, knowing, but sometimes you don't know, right? Sometimes you switch around and you figure stuff out and you end up in the situation. Okay. So you're in this situation. Then I think there's two ways. One, you either got to skip around.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to not
raise. Right. Mm-hmm.
Catch up, right? And get to the point where it, mm-hmm. where it all, the math all makes sense. Or two, look what Julian's saying, everyone's got to eat it. All the internal people, we got to stomach like a reset. And that's really hard.
Yes.
We had a option 2B. So we were able to raise a round from a unique person, individual who was not a fund. So they did not have these dynamics and these sorts of things. And we were able to have terms that appeased our current investor base, but still kept the valuation at a good level.
Huh.
The terms being, they still kept all their own ownership. So there was no like crammed down set of anything, but we shifted preferred stock to common stock.
And your existing investors, well,
not
I mean,
all of them.
Not all of them were happy. Yeah.
Not, like this is better than cramming people down.
Yeah.
This is better than not raising and the company dying.
Mm-hmm.
Some people did not understand this, but we believed this was definitely the right path. In hindsight, it was definitely the right path.
Uh-huh.
It solved solutions for everybody.
It's
very hard to do because you got to find this like person who can lead around, and they didn't care about their ownership like a VC fund.
Mm-hmm.
They were like a strategic, could be a partnership, and said, I'll own whatever the value.
But we need, we need the round and the cap table look like this for us to put money in.
Right.
There's nobody else that's willing to put capital in it. So it's like, what are you going to do?
Joe, I see you. I see you. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking there's probably like 1,000 founders right now that want that person's phone number. Everyone's sitting on these crazy valuations and the market has reset and everyone's dealing with this issue. And it's so rare to get that deal done. I'm just like imagining how tedious and brutal those internal conversations had to be.
We had amazing for 6 months already, and we were left with 2 months of money.
Yeah.
By the time we had that conversation.
Yeah. So like, but it's hard when the deals get complicated. You know, a lot of times people just check out and don't
want
a deal.
They're just like,
So it's, you know, it's amazing you got that done. It's really incredible.
He also, back to the weird investors. Okay. The weird investors often, and I'll just, boy, do I want to trash talk Sequoia here?
Yes.
I've never worked with Sequoia. So, but I will say you,
so
when you have 10 hot companies and eight of them, even eight of them, are like not doing so hot, you still got two amazing companies that are the best of the best when you're Sequoia, right? And so what happens to an investor, and this is like a weird perspective that I've gained as a result of working with a lot of investors that were not in the A tier at my last company. Mikhail, you have the same experience, or you might think about it differently. Those people need you more because they don't have tons of hot companies in their portfolio. So it's almost like when a challenge occurs, not Sequoia specifically, but a hot firm will be like, actually, no, you're dead to us. But a B level firm will be like, you know what? We're tied together. We need you. We're going to lean in. And I don't know if this is something that you feel applied to what happened at your company.
I wish more were felt tied to us. I actually felt that we didn't have enough believers. I think some that were tied, as you're saying, Julian, were not looking as long-term as we were. So the ones that were tied weren't necessarily offset by others that were tied also, who were thinking a bit long-term about the business. So we just had this like misbalance.
Mm-hmm.
And the founders couldn't fill that gap. You needed like other investors to be thinking longer.
Yeah.
And we did get that in that last round that we figured out with the, you know, the unique person leading it. And then that's the round that Jeff Lewis and Bedrock came in, and that dynamic changed a lot of things for the company being more long-term.
So walk that through for people listening. So it took that one investor to come in, clean the cap table up.
It's not Jeff Lewis, right?
No, I know. So this other, it sounds like a strategic investor, they came up and cleaned up the cap table, and that actually made room and it attractable for Jeff Lewis, who is now running Bedrock.
We round open that lead investor because they weren't a VC fund. They didn't have ownership percentage targets to hit, which would have messed up the dynamics of the round. So I don't remember the exact amount they wanted, but it was like, we'll do 5 million and we'll only take like, I don't remember the exact, but like 10% instead of the normal 20%. So left a huge chunk for other people to come in. The valuation was high enough where it wouldn't have diluted everybody a ton. So that fit really well. I want to go with the, like Joe's point, finding that person, just click on that so people have a solution. I didn't know this person was going to do this. I wrote to this person thinking that maybe they want to angel invest 10K. I'm going to scrape together some stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that because crypto, this is the hype, was coming up and they had a crypto company. They wanted to partner with us, that there was an opportunity. And that was bigger than just him individually. So his company actually came in with the investment. Mm-hmm. And to Joe's point, this was actually just me not giving up. So everyone was tired in our company with this fundraising with December, right? You went through that whole cycle. You had the September cycle, all those people, no one following up. It's stupid. You're trying to do your weird follow-up games to get people to follow up, which is the dumbest game because they know you're playing the game, all the investors, and like, this person needs money. Stop following up. And then December comes, still no one. And it's like, you got to reset. You got to think through that. And I was like, I remember the decision. I'm like, fuck it. I'm just going to start writing to more people, new people. I'm done with these.
Yes. Yes.
And that was it. That decision. Then we went to San Francisco and I'm on the block. And then I start getting calls from some of the funds. And then that person, I'm like, I don't trust this. The fund's not going to happen. So I'm going to write to this guy and let me see what could happen here because we're going to need something unique. And I'm like, can you want to do 10K if you want to invest? And I said, I know you said you wanted to invest back. We were talking about partnership, and he writes back, could I do 5 million? That's very well. And I remember I'm on the block with Steph, and I'm going to the next meeting, and is this real? Okay, like probably not. So let's keep doing all this stuff. But then it was real. And so to the point of Joe, like, how do you find this person? You keep going. It's just like,
You got to keep going.
Exploit stuff. Yeah. And it's the, like what we were saying with Kevin, like, don't start a company. Yes, start a company. But know this shit and still want to start a company because then you will go and do this stuff.
Mm-hmm. You got to keep on going. Like, I've been through many rounds, even especially with Airhouse. I'd say that like marketplaces are uniquely hard to start and get like really good liquidity, especially when you have more than server costs and you like, for us, we have partners on our back end and stuff like that. So like we went through a couple rounds where it was like, I just kept on reaching out to, and this would be like a seed plus or a C plus plus. I think we did a C plus and a C plus plus. And like, it was just like continuing to reach out to more and more people. And it's just like, we got this lucky intro from one person and it's like the round got done. And like, that's what you gotta do. And you gotta talk to 60 people around sometimes, especially in this environment. I will say, like, a lot of people right now, there's not a lot of firms out there writing checks. It's like, you're talking to 60, 70 people and it's fucking brutal, but that's what you gotta do. And you gotta keep on going. And then sometimes it's, if you know you have a good company, like obviously, Mikhail, you knew, like, you're looking at the numbers growing, like, we have something here. It's just going to take all it takes is one person to write that $5 million check or whatever. And so you just got to keep on going. But it is it's tough and it's draining. And, but that's what it takes. And that's what you're getting when you get, to your point, Mikhail, like, that's what you get when you go and start a startup. Like, that's what you're signing up for. It's a lot of ups and a lot of like really down, like the lows are really low. The highs are really high.
I was sitting at dinner with Sam Korkos in New York a couple of weeks ago. I brought this up in a previous episode. Sam said to me, because we were talking about growth, he said, my first 400 customers I got by putting the phone number in the drip email, my own personal phone number, and they all personally called me And I personally sold each one of these levels products to him, to the customer, literally on the phone right there. It's the kind of thing that the average founder would not do. And what happens is you have the whole round, you have this money. You're like, we're doing great. We just raised this financing. Some of the money is gone now, $1 million, $2 million. You're like, okay, this isn't exactly playing out the way that I thought, but we're still going to do okay. A couple more million drained from your bank account. Now you're like, okay, it's still going pretty good, but it's not going as great as I thought. And then you hit this level that Mikhail is talking about at some point, and you go, you know what? Fuck it. We're just going to try everything. And that's actually when it happens.
Yep.
I wish I had the foresight to do that on day one when the round is raised. But I'm going to level with you. It takes me a little bit for me to lose my confidence, for me to get desperate, and then I get better at my job, which is crazy, you know? And so
can I make one point? Because this is an ongoing debate between me, Julian, and Andy on the podcast as far as how much you should be raising. This is my whole point of like raise as little capital as you need to get to the next stage, because it pushes you to the exact point that you're at, Julian, that uncomfortable position that like you need to go do X, Y, and Z, and also makes you make those hard decisions. Like right now we're sitting in a time that there's a lot of companies that are really flush with capital. And they are going to be trying to be spending and hiring big execs and getting consultants and management consultants in. Like I did that before at Ship. Like we even hired McKinsey and trying to figure out like it was insane. And it's just like that. Those are the things you do when you have so much money. But it's like when you don't, it's like you just throw everything at the wall. It's like We're running out of money. We have nothing to do. And like, or it's like early on when you don't have a lot of money and you know that you have 6 months of runway, whatever, it just forces you to be focused versus like unfocused and spending way too much money, hiring way too senior people that are not like really grinding like the way that we're talking, like that all of us have really been grinding before.
Joe, does this happen at every company? Please tell me no. Does it happen?
I mean, it's so hard when you get that big check to not have a bunch of teams and swing at a bunch of, you know, big ideas. And it is, yeah, there's a story, I think Phil Jackson, who was the coach of the Lakers, that I think told the story of Kobe Bryant in high school letting other teams get up by points so it motivate him to take over the game. And I think about that a lot in like startups where, you know, like those moments when you do feel like your back's against the wall, like the best ideas come, the team gets the most motivated, like the lucky things fall in your lap. Like it all just starts, you know, coming together in a lot of ways.
Mikhail, do you feel like you could put yourself in that place again now today?
It hurts a lot. Also, let's like,
it hurts.
Yeah. And it just like, you don't know if anyone else is going to, I think it's, you don't know if anyone else is going to believe.
Right.
Like you see everything and you're like, it's all there. And the fear is you're creating all this stuff. And that's why I'm a bit jaded with raising money now. Cause I did so much of making stuff to like raise money. So you help it grow for the investors. You had to do this for the investors.
Yeah.
That I'm less interested in that now. I still think great businesses are based on some of those same principles. Like you got to grow, otherwise,
of course, yeah,
you're dying. But there's some in there that can be a bit toxic. Like eventually, if you think about it the wrong way.
I think if you move countries, it'd be easier. There's a lot.
This is my text thread with Kevin.
Yeah, there's a lot more. There's a lot more optimistic people in, I'll just say San Francisco, because that's where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also where and actually right now, like it is happening again in the city. Like SF is like the AI like revolution again. Like everybody's talking about it and it's like the place to be, but everybody is just so like positive. And that's one thing. And I don't want to like push Canada down so far, but a lot, I think Silicon Valley, like it created this. It was like, it was based on like optimism and also other founders helping other founders out for no reason. Like this is why we wanted to do this podcast. We want to help other people starting out. We don't get anything from this. We're not going to run ads on this. And Mikhail, if we are, Mikhail will ask you what the ad strategy is going to be, but we won't. But it's just kind of infectious, and it's just like people believe more. And I don't know if that is like a Silicon Valley ish. And I think Silicon Valley is not like an actual like place anymore. It's more of like a way of living, but that's what it's like. I'm curious, Mikhail, are you thinking about getting back in the arena? After this, what's next for you?
Yeah, I have thoughts. I mean, my thoughts are really like starting a company is always going to be a problem that I have. I feel that I can solve things best in that way. So I've seen the alternatives. I know how to probably make something that's 10 times better, a lot easier if it's solving my own problem. I've got two young kids. So there's a lot of problems in the kid space. If you've got kids, everything sucks. All the product sucks.
Yeah. Me and Joe have kids. Yeah. Two kids as well. Yeah.
All the operations suck. Logistics suck. Nothing is made for it. So there's a lot of interesting things in there, but I know what it takes to build a company and the level of energy and the focus. And I got to make sure that also is in the right spot to be doing that. And on your point about Silicon Valley, I always have thoughts about going there. Actually, this would always be my first thought when I'm starting, if I were to start something again, should this be somewhere else? Should I be somewhere else?
Right.
Yeah. Because of a lot of the challenges that I did have here.
There's a few minutes left. I see something in your face that I would like to blurt out. And if it's not right, then that's okay. But I feel like there is a part of you that is angry. Do you feel like there's a part of you that is angry about what went down or how it went down? Do you sense that?
I was angry the most during that fundraising before we got the unique person to like figure it out and get the round done. Because we had so much there, and it was like everything that I had thought was like wrong. Growth is not enough.
Right.
You know, all those things that I had, even if you tell a good story, like I thought our deck was great. We had gone through everything. Like I'd pitched it a million times. Everything felt that we could control, felt like it was so good and so in line with everything that we've read, all the Sequoia blogs, all the Hacker News stuff. And even like there's levels to that, right? And even like a V2 of that, like it was like good. And like, and it still couldn't happen. Like it was still so hard, and it was still stuff that was like blindsiding me as the reason why, like the cap table thing. That was the most angering part. And then realizing that cap table thing, and you have to fix that somehow. And you can fix it, but you can't like fix it all the way. And that was like the second moment where you have this realization, and it's like, do we have to sell a company? Like my brain had always only thought about massive public company. Like I was looking at public company stock tickers on day one of the company to see what we could get, and it would be cool, you know, when we go public. And that was always my thought process. So those two shifts, like, those are the points where I was most angry. I am not angry now.
I'm happy to hear it. That's a good way to end it, maybe.
I think so.
We're doing pretty good. Joe, great to have you on. Kevin, great to have you. Julian, me, great to be here with Mikhail and everybody else. It's exciting.
Thanks so
to
much,
talk
Mikhail,
to you.
For joining.
Thank you, guys.
Be nice to have you on sometime in the future. And congratulations on everything that has happened and everything that is yet to come.
And thanks to everybody for listening. Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Second Time Founders Podcast, talking tech news. The show is a must, not some billionaire trying to sell you their book. We're coming from a real place, plenty ups and downs, got some insights. Join the discussion now. We being honest and raw, giving you real talk. We've been at the bottom and made it happen and much more. The Second Time Founders Podcast, more building, less talk.